So good afternoon. Hi, Flora. How are you? What's happening in your parenting world?
Well, I think my son took the PSATs last month, so I think that gave us a little introduction. Of course, that means that now I'm going to expect all the mailings from colleges we probably didn't even ask for to send. You know that these PSATs are nothing more than just us signing off our kids' names away so that colleges and all these other programs can send stuff to us.
Well, yeah, I mean, hopefully, you know, they'll score high enough for merit scholarships. I mean, I hope Amadi does. He had been studying for these PSATs for the last 2.5 years. So I hope he scores high enough to, you know, qualify for some merit scholarships. That would be pretty awesome. Right. But then you're right. We are definitely just signing on for our kids to have their names in these databases. But that right. But like college is a racket, right? Like college is a game. It's a moneymaker. It's a business.
It is. I already get like the charter school mailings too for the younger one. They don't stop, even though I opted out of the DOE system, but I still get charter school mailings. But and so now I'm expecting the colleges.
Yeah, right. So that's a great segue into today's conversation with Akil Bello about the college admissions process. So you know what? Let's just jump right in over there.
Yeah, sounds good. Okay. Hello. So welcome to another episode of New Normal in Parenting. And today we have to discuss college admissions. We have our guest, Akil Bello. So some of you might know Akil if you've ever caught the Netflix documentary, Operation Varsity Blues. Akil is one of the three consultants that they interviewed during this documentary. I finally, by the way, caught it last week. I mean, obviously nothing new, I didn't know before, but if you follow his Twitter profile, he actually does call himself a Netflix adult film star. Not exactly what you think about, of course, as an adult film star, but that is his name. And his Twitter profile names are pretty interesting, too. Everything from Shaka Khan Academy to Belviv DeVos to now Horish Man right now. And I actually got a chance to know Akil myself also via Twitter as we had multiple conversations about the validity of the specialized high school admissions test. In fact, thanks to Akil, I learned that Play-Doh was originally used for cleaning coal from coal-fired stoves. Who knew that that's what it was? It was a cleaning agent. Who knew that that's what it was used for? I guess, Akil, if you can introduce yourself and talk about some of the work that you do and why you're in such high demand. I mean, every time there's something out there, every time someone sends me anything about college admissions, the validity of testing, you're there.
Well, thanks for having me on. I don't know why I'm all over the place. I guess because I'm reckless in what I say. So I am the brief history is I'm a longtime test prep tutor, teacher, businessman. I've been a tutor for over 30 years. I ran my own business for 11 years. I've taught every standardized admissions test you've probably ever heard of, from the IEC and the SSAT for admissions to middle schools to the GMAT, the LSAT, the GRE for admissions to grad school. The way I usually say it is I'll teach any test that doesn't require real knowledge. So I don't mess with things like the MCAT because you have to know science. And so most recently, I'm a senior director at FAIRTEST, the National Center for Fair and Open Testing. And my work revolves around policy and more advocating for more limited, more transparent, more reasonable use of standardized tests. So that's what I do.
And I know the other thing that you work on, of course, is giving parents guidance for college admissions. And this is, well, last year I think was kind of a, I guess what we call a natural experiment, where a whole group of high school seniors had to go through the entire college admissions process and deal with a pandemic at the same time. And now we have a second cohort that's also dealing with this right now. So needless to say, there's probably a lot of anxiety happening right now. And so we're curious, what are you hearing from parents, from students? And Ebony and I both have incoming juniors. So we're looking at the college admissions process ourselves. Oh, yeah. What advice are you giving to parents, students, and what are they telling you?
I mean, this year, the last 2 years really, has been messy. It's been, you know, things are in flux. So I think generally what I'm trying to convey to parents is to opt out as much as they can from the madness. I think that a lot of the anxiety and stress is driven by a rigid adherence to chronology, right? So much of our education system is really about chronology. If you test well at 4, you are therefore gifted and talented for life. Like, so somehow if you test well at 5, you're not. Right. So all of these things are chronology driven, like even the learning loss narrative, right? Like if you took it at the most generous way we could take that narrative, and let's not be cynical and say it's test prep company or test publishers trying to make money. Let's pretend that that's not the case. Let's say like learning loss is a real thing, right? There has been different at best and worse at worst, you know, less instruction this past year. That means if we want people to learn the same amount of information, it's going to take time to recover from that or to get back to where we wanted them to be. So it's really only a question of time, right? So I think that if we accept that pandemic means things are not on the same schedule they were, then like you can chill out from a lot of the panic, because no college is going to reject a child because they're 18, not 17. Right? No, you know, so you can always learn things later in life. And so I think that part of the whole thing I'm trying to get across to parents when I talk to them is like, don't freak out around changes in the schedule you expected. Yeah, it's not the schedule you were planning on when your child was born. But guess what? There's a pandemic. You didn't count on that. And the pandemic changes things. Right? And like, and if we look at it that way, then okay, right? I think a lot of this is driven by stress and rigid schedules that we don't necessarily have to adhere to.
I like that you talked about chronology, because as Flora mentioned, we both have juniors, but I have a freshman. He's 15, like he's going into ninth grade as a 15-year-old. So he always says like, I'm gonna be like 19, 20 when I go to college. And I'm like, yeah, that's fine. I don't think it'll be a problem, but that's just me trying to not make him feel bad that he's gonna be 15. But I like that you said that it's the chronology. So it kind of, I feel like you just made me feel better as a mom, because we have some of us, you know, have, like, he's in a private school system, so he's much older going into high school. And then what does that look like in college? Do they care or they don't even care?
Of course not. They're paying attention to when did you graduate high school? What did you do in high school, more importantly, right? And so I think part of it is also, it's interesting that when certain groups do things, it's negative, and when other groups do it, it's positive, mm-hmm. right? He's 15 in private school, probably on par with the vast majority of his classmates. Mm-hmm. So he's not old in the private school setting because if you have more money, you might keep your child home for an extra year. You're not pressured to start them at 5 to get them out of the house so that you can go to work, mm-hmm. right? So generally private school, the children are older, mm-hmm. right? They're also not adhering to a public school schedule, which I think is largely driven by we've set the start age as 5 so that parents can get out of the house and go to work. and let's get the economy moving, right? So I think that part of it is recognizing what drives these perceptions, these schedules, what's driving them, what's creating them, and how irrelevant they truly are. Like,
I just remember, I just remember when I used to teach college, and when I used to teach at Stuyvesant High School. And of course, you know, you had all these students who were like focused on, I got to get into this school. I got to go in that school. I got to figure out how much scholarship money. And I told them the story. I just told them a random story about a friend of mine who got a bachelor's in computer science from Columbia. And he started out as a security guard there at Columbia. They're like, what? Like, yeah, well, apparently Columbia has this program where they allow all employees to take up to 7 credits a semester for free. And he just took advantage of this program and just kept on taking classes until eventually he had enough credits to graduate with a degree in computer science. Like, this is someone who wasn't even going to college, didn't even think about it. He was just signed up to become a security guard, and he's got BS in computer science from Columbia University. So they're like, really?
You know, by some calculations, he didn't do it right. You know, he's a non-traditional student. I mean, think about, like, if you run it down all across the board, we talk about 4-year colleges, right? Like, we talk about a 4-year degree. That's a lie. Like, you know, I took 7 years to get my degree, right? Like, the government actually tracks 6-year and 8-year graduation rates. So there is no 4-year degree. There's 128 credits that you need to get the degree, no matter how you take them. If you take them X amount per semester, yes, you will graduate in 4 years. But if you don't do that, then you won't. And maybe you do it in 2 years.
And, you know, the state gives people with disabilities 6 years to graduate college if they're funding them. So why is that not pushed to tell everyone you don't have to do it in 4 years?
Because
right? Is it a money thing?
Partially. All right. Like a lot of financial aid programs are driven around a 4-year schedule. I feel like you can get, don't quote me on this, but like Pell might be something like you can get 8 semesters of Pell, or maybe it's 12 semesters of Pell, something like that. So there is an actual limit to it. Mm-hmm. Because I guess it makes sense, right? If I'm giving out the money, I don't want to say you can go to college forever. Right? Like, if I hold the purses, yeah, y'all better get out quick. All right, so that's part of the issue.
So you often mention the hype around certain colleges and universities, which you refer to as highly rejective schools as opposed to highly reputable schools. Do you think that the pandemic has changed the way parents and students look at college admissions for the better, or has the competition to get in these schools gotten worse?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I think it depends on how you look at that competition, right? So I think there's two things that are in play. One is brand name. So I started calling colleges highly rejective because I hate the word elite. I hate I thought selective was also too complimentary of those same schools. And I wanted to start us thinking about what are we measuring and why do we consider, you know, looking at none of the educational outcomes. Certain places are held to esteem, which I thought was false. You know, so that's part of why I started framing it like that. Because one of the issues is just like, what makes a good college? And I don't think most people define that when they're in the college process. They're looking for a place that is called good, but they don't define what makes a school good, right? And so the older, more wealthy institutions have reputation that has almost nothing to do with their outcomes. It has to do with, you know, this is Stanford is the oldest college, you know, a bunch of fancy people went there, therefore it must be good. And US News has ranked it high because US News actually measures wealth. Mm-hmm. Like all their ranking is driven by wealthy indicators at the place, not actually the education you get. So I think if you study English, pretty much any college will have a really good English program. Right. You know, now if you're studying, I don't know, nuclear physics or something like that, yeah, maybe MIT is a better spot because there's not a whole lot of places that do nuclear physics. Right. But I think most people aren't looking at it like that. most people are like, I heard about this place. It was rated really high. And so I thought turning the language around to highly reject and say, like, that place is fancy because it rejects a lot of people. Right. That makes us think about it a little bit more. Like, is that really what I'm interested in? Right. And I think that's important because the pressure to get into a highly rejected place is high. It's a popularity contest, right? To me, it's wearing polo on your shirt. Like, I won't wear any company that has a big old logo. I'm not your billboard. So, you know, that's like, not why I buy clothing.
Come on and talk about the college popularity contest, because I mean, these parents on social media, now I'm about to get on my soapbox, but like these parents on social media with the whole like announcement, and I'm yes. just like, I'm sure your kid was amazing, but like, let's also keep in line, like they completed the application in a timely manner. They everything was correct, right? Like right. It's a lot. It's yes. really a lot sometimes for me. And I'm just like, what would have happened if your kid didn't get into that name brand school? Would you still have the fanfare, or would you right. just be like, yeah, he's over there? Right. I wonder.
That's a huge problem, is that, you know, it's brand. It's someone saying, I have red bottoms, therefore, like, and to me, I'm just like, what does that mean? It means absolutely, I don't know if those shoes are comfortable. I don't know if they're, I know you spent a lot. That's really all I know, right? And so, you know, I think that we have to reconsider how we're evaluating colleges. Now, if you can point to, I can get an education here that I can't get anywhere else, I'm all on board, right? You know, I was ready to send all my students to UNC because Nicole Hannah-Jones was about to be there. I'm like, yes, let's all go. They got Tressie McMillan Cotton, and they got Nicole Hannah. Let's go. Everybody go to USC. And then they dropped the ball. So it's like, all right, now maybe we'll go to Howard because, you know, they got Felicia Rashad. And like, hey, let's go. Right. So, you know, at least I know if I can sit in a classroom with those people, there is some evidence of there's some good learning that's going to happen. Right. But at most places, we can't track down particular professors that are, you know, that I would want to learn at the feet of. So I think that we should look at colleges more clearly around what will the educational experience be. In the pandemic, a couple of things have sort of happened. One is applications have slightly risen, especially at particular places. Families are applying less far than they used to, so more close to home. But also it seems that, you know, there's a slight bump in the number of applications per student going out. That's probably because, you know, everybody has free time now because we're all at home for the last year and a half. So let's, like, I bet that has a lot of people like, I ain't going nowhere. Let me do one more application. Right. So applications are up, which means that at some of these places, admissions rates are going to go down. Right. And some people will interpret that to mean it's a better school. It's, you know, it's this. But no, it just meant they got more applications and they did not increase the number of seats. That's just math. So it's like, so selectivity, you know, the admission rate means almost nothing except for math.
Yeah. Actually, I remember Stuyvesant, the college office, actually had limits of how many colleges a student can apply. I mean, I don't get it when I see some of them applying to 10, 15 schools. It's like, why? All you need to apply for is 6 maximum, right? You know, 1 reach, 1, you know, 2 reach, 2 safeties, and 2, you know, targets.
Well, it's like, that's
Right,
and that's the problem with the whole process, right? The whole problem is like there actually are no answers. There's suggestions, right. There's thoughts, there's considerations, but there are no answers. If you truly don't know where you want to go as a student, and there's no way to predict your financial aid before applying, right?
Right.
And you want to study English, and everybody has an English department.
Right.
Let's apply everywhere and see who gives me the best package. I'm kind of on board with that if you have the time and the resources to do it. Right now, plus like Stuyvesant says, I'm not sending out 1,700 transcripts. And I also understand that. It's like, you're in a college office. Like, I'm not sending out 43 transcripts and 43 letters of recommendations for little Johnny. Right? Like,
right. Yeah, the other issue is that they were concerned that if this student applied for this college, it would decrease the chances of another, which itself really is, when you think about it, let's be a little considerate. I mean, I don't know if you read my piece on the specialized high school admissions test, but I had a student who told me that when he came back to visit me, he went to Colgate, and he chose Colgate because they happened to have an environmental science program that he specifically wanted. And all the students, of course, looked at him like, why did you choose that school? Like, right. Really? Because I don't know, maybe it was what it was made for. But the other issue, of course, is that we're now, one of the things that we saw with the pandemic was the SATs and the ACTs, mm-hmm. where, you know, a lot of these schools are basically becoming test optional right now. And I actually had a chance to see my son take the AP computer science exam at home. And I'm like, what was the purpose of this? Really? Like, if he scores high, who's going to take that credit? If he scores a one or two, any college will understand that it's in the middle of a pandemic. And if they don't, then that college is not worth going to. Thank you. And, So we're seeing more and more of schools actually consider going test optional. And I guess, does this really show the relevance or lack of relevance of these exams? Like, where do you see, if any, a place for the SAT and the ACT exam right now? And as well as all the others, the achievements, the SAT twos, the AP exams.
So there's a lot of different things there. One is recognizing that your perspective as a Stuyvesant parent, as somebody immersed in that specialized world, is very different, right? These are largely people who, going into the school and when they got to the school, are told stand guard or die, right? There's an impression created around that environment that if you don't get into these highly rejective places, somehow that's not as good, right? So to me, I think those people, I understand what they're doing. I'm not a fan of that approach, right? I'm not a fan of, to me, it's kind of trophy hunting. It's valuing brand over all other things. Now, not to diminish that, because there is value to it, right? But I'm particularly, as a person, I'm brand averse. I won't buy Polo because they put their logo on the shirt too big. I was like, which is probably as bad as the person who does buy it because of the logo, right? So I definitely recognize that, like, and it's kind of like me going selective, rejective, right? It's like I'm just going to flip it the other way. I don't know that it's better, but I'm flipping it anyway, damn it. So I do want to frame things and make sure I'm saying, yeah, I recognize that I'm as arbitrary just the other way, right? But the vast majority of colleges in the United States admit more than half the people that apply to them, right? So the vast students in the country can find a college to go to, right? The vast number of colleges in the United States don't need additional tools, additional hurdles for students to jump through to let them in. And depending on how the college applies its mission, if the mission is to educate those who come, then why do I need to put them through 7,000 hoops in order to decide to let them educate themselves, right? I think places that create additional hoops have one or two things in mind. One is they have far more applications than they have candidates, and so they're looking to justify rejecting certain people, right? And I say justify because, in truth, at most of these highly selected places, if you take, you know, if they admit 1,000, if you take the next 1,000, they will all be equally successful, right? So there's very little academic difference between the people they admit and the people they reject, right? There's sort of a weird underlying narrative in a lot of these admissions processes that there are, you know, unwashed hordes of people trying to get in who will never be able to do the work. And that's just not true, right? Like, the vast majority of people can do the work in most of these places, right? If they have the tools and the resources to do the work, right? Now I say most because I believe that, you know, your Georgia Techs and Caltechs, the super specialized, you know, places, like, yeah, you got to come ready to do Calc 2 because that's where they start you, maybe, right? But 98% of majors don't need calculus. So, well, you know, so why are we worried about it? Like, who's done calculus and who hasn't, right? So I think that that's part of the problem, is that the narrative driven by highly selective, highly specialized, highly in-demand program start to permeate all of college admissions as if this is a requirement for everywhere. And then you have businesses that grow up around that say, we're going to help you sort. So right. The SAT and the ACT, you know, they provide some information, but I don't know how useful it is. And actually, I do know it's not very useful. So if you look at validity data, the SAT and the ACT, they add some small measure of prediction of first year college GPA slightly above what high school GPA already provides, right? But let's flip it and go and ask you a different question. Let me ask you a question. Would you be willing to cost society and the government $2 billion a year in order for a college to predict its first year grades better by 6%?
No.
Right? Oh, that's the you just said test optional. You just said test free.
So it's interesting because my son has been preparing for the SAT since freshman year, right? Because he's in a program like that.
Makes me so sad.
You know, I mean, listen, I don't know this. I don't know this lifestyle that he right. lives, right? I don't know this high achieving, high average lifestyle. I don't understand being upset about grades. I'm like, I got a C. We'll keep it moving, right? But like he has said, I am going to take the PSAT once, and I am going to take the SAT once, and then I will be done with it. And I'm going to do it in junior year, and I'm done. And I'm like, if that's what you want to do, that sounds good to me, because I don't see the need for all of that. But that's where his academics and his education has led him into these spaces. But I'm also that parent who got on the phone with a college advisor and said, you will not offer him any Ivies. You will not offer him any SUNYs, because if he can't pull in the bag related to financial aid, he's not going to a PWI. If so I got to pay, he's going to go to an HBCU.
Let me push back on kind of all of that.
Please do.
So... And I'm going to fully understand that I'm about to contradict myself. And this is what's important as a parent, right? I think there's two different things I do in my work. One is talk to parents about individual situations of their child. Mm-hmm. And two, talk about the system in which we are working, mm-hmm. right? My job is to fix the system, right? Stuyvesant using the specialized high school test as the sole means of entry is a broken system that's actually anti-science, and it's against how the test is supposed to be used. That system needs to change. Mm-hmm. That a parent wants to go to Stuyvesant and needs to prepare their child for that test makes sense. The system exists as it is currently, so you have to play the game of the system as it is, despite what we want the system to be. So if I want my child to go to Stuyvesant, I'm going to do the test prep because the test still exists, right? And I think that with college admissions, you kind of have to look at it the same way. I don't know that I would be down for saying no Ivies, because maybe they give him more money.
That's the only reason to go. That's right. My reason. But that's the only reason to go.
But you won't know until the application is filed. So now he should apply, right? Like, that's the problem here, right? Like, there's no information until he's applied and then he gets his response, right? So I think that what we have to do as parents is create as many options as possible and don't limit those things until the time comes to limit them. Now, when you get the offers and it's $50,000 a year to go to Harvard, or $20,000 a year to go to Morgan State, right? That kind of sounds like a pretty easy decision, right?
Definitely.
But what if it's $20,000 a year to go to Harvard and $50,000 a year to go to Morgan State?
Mm-hmm.
Now things are getting complicated.
Right.
What if Harvard is free and Morgan is 10?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, so I can't tell you what to do, but I can tell you that if you don't apply to Harvard, you'll never have that question. I'd rather have to make that decision than, you know, when it comes down to money.
Well, he gets one. He gets one IV cell plasma.
No.
I remember when I was applying for colleges, my dad told me, don't bother applying for any of the privates because I don't have money. So that was basically his outlook on it. He said he just didn't think we were going to get anything.
And I tell parents, like, just don't take the option off the table. Apply. There's no harm in applying. You get told no. Y'all both live in New York. You get told no every day in the bodega, in the subway, far ruder than a college will ever tell your child no. Right, some of them are gonna say no, but it's always a warm hug. It's like, oh, we think you're wonderful, but we ain't admitting you. Right? It's like, oh, you give me a compliment and then say no. It's like, okay, I guess that's nice. Right? So they're gonna get some no's, but we want as many yeses as possible to choose from is ultimately what people are trying to decide, right? And I think that the anxiety in the process comes from trying to predict the outcome, right?
Yeah, which is
right. I don't know that we can. I would not try to predict the outcome. I would choose where I want to apply, and then I would apply. I think that so much of college admissions right now is around game theory in predicting the outcome and avoidance of no's. Right? People are fighting hard to accumulate yeses and avoid no's. And I actually don't think it's relevant. I don't care if my kid gets one yes and 17 no's. Right? Ideally, he'll get multiple yeses with different financial aid packages where I have to make the decision. But if he gets one yes and 17 no's, he's still going to college. So I'm okay with that. Right? So I think that all the gamesmanship of trying to assure admission to place XYZ is not worth the hassle.
I mean, but and also just going back to the special, a lot of those standardized exams, when you think about it, it's like the approach that I've, at least the approach that I take with my kid is just go in there and do the best you can. Well, that's how we handle the specialized high school test, admission test. Just go in and do the best you can. And so, but I'm probably the exception, right? I mean, all of his friends were like studying 3 hours a day for that exam since like sixth grade. And I'm like, just go ahead and do the best you can, kid. And but at the same time, you know, you just, you got to do it. Like it opens some doors because some schools are still not test optional. I mean, look, even if you look at the history of how the SATs, right? Supposedly, Carl Brigham was asked to come in and create this test because apparently they were trying to, they didn't like all these, what do you call it? Grotto sex, those six prep schools that were all feeding into the Ivy Leagues. And he was tired of the kids from St. Grotto sex just getting in. And in his naive world, he wanted to, the dean of Harvard wanted to create this exam that focused solely on natural ability, where you weren't supposed to study for the exam. That was, of course, thrown out immediately. You know, when you have people like Kaplan who figured out how to manipulate the exam.
Well, it's also now, like, it's not even reasonable. What possible thing can I test that somebody can't study for? Right, like that thing doesn't exist.
Right. I mean, I had my younger brother never studied for the exam. He opened a Princeton review book, and it insulted his intelligence. The whole Joe Blow, it insulted his intelligence. He just did not want to do it, and he got a 1400. This was in 1995.
Right, and that's fine. I mean, I think that the whole issue with the testing is recognizing that A, it's measuring something. Generally not what they tell you it's measuring. It is not a pure objective measurement of your intellectual capacity or aptitude or any of those sort of words. It is a narrow measure of particular skills that they thought you should have, right? So if you haven't learned those things that they thought you should have learned, then you're not going to do well on their test, right? So to me, it's as if I decided, let's test everyone on lacrosse to see who's a good athlete. Right? There's some rationale to that. Lacrosse requires athleticism.
Right.
Right? But clearly, lacrosse gonna favor a certain group of people.
Yeah, right? I mean.
So if we don't acknowledge that, that test is problematic.
Yeah, I mean,
lacrosse too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I pointed out to my brother is that, look, you're still the son of an engineer. That's the yep. reality, that you're still mm-hmm. the son of an engineer. And we have, and even though he's, you know, even though English is not his first language, and we're probably not as savvy as some of these more educated American-born parents, you're still the son of an engineer, and you did a mm-hmm. lot of reading. And that gave you certain advantages over the kid who didn't, which I guess goes into our next question about inequities, that we know that the process does favor certain parents. And I know we've had these conversations too. It's not even necessarily low income. It's just parents who are devoted to getting, you know, I think someone I knew once explained it to, you're just coming from an Asian background. It's just like, it's like the equivalent of showbiz moms. That's exactly what it is. We are like the equivalent of showbiz. Thankfully, I did not have those kinds of parents. But I know plenty of people who grew up in that environment. And that gives you advantages that people don't think about. Like, I'm sorry, just immigrating to this country means you had the means to come here and had the will to come here. And that gives you an advantage over other people. So
once you create a yeah. focus on a particular objective, right? When you think about people who are trying to get into some of these places, there's a very intentional, long-term, multi-year focus on one particular outcome, and they're putting all their resources into achieving that outcome, right? And whatever those resources are, if you hyper-focus on being good at one thing, odds are you're gonna get there, right? I think the problem comes in when we ignore that not everyone has those opportunities. So you achieving it doesn't necessarily mean you're better, brighter, smarter, faster, more qualified, more meritorious than the other person. It means that you worked it and you got there. That's lovely and great, but the narratives and the language that's often used suggests that those who didn't get there are somehow less than, right? And that's part of the problem. I think that, you know, that's why, like, for me, standardized tests don't have very many false positives, but they often have false negatives, right? Like, you have to know some stuff to get a 1400 on the SAT, absolutely, right? But the odds that someone who got a, you know, 900 knows nothing, that's not true, right? They don't have the skills, maybe the knowledge. They certainly didn't perform well, but I don't really know what the 900 means, right? I know for sure the 400 meant you performed well and you knew a bunch of stuff, not the 1400, right? But I'd have to meet the student to figure out what the 900 means. And I think that often what happens with standardized testing is that those numbers are accepted with no further thought, right? They treat a, you know, 1410 as if it is different than a 1400. I'd have almost no issue with the SAT and the ACT if they were scored on a 6-point scale. Because you know what? If you did your best, if you did all your prep and whatever, like if we assume that these two students performed, you know, did all the things they could to get ready for the test and one scores a 6 and one scores a 1, then yes, the person who scores a 6 knows more of the things tested on that test. Like notice how often I have to caveat everything I say, right? Because like knows more ain't true. Because I can score better than, you know, my 12-year-old on SAT, ACT, all of that, but he can recite all the lyrics to Hamilton. He can name every actor in the entire show, and I can barely name the writer, right? So, like, he knows more than me if we get into anything about the entertainment industry, right? But I know more than him when we're talking about high school math and standardized testing, you know? Almost every student I tutor for the SAT these days knows more math than I do, knows harder math than I do. I would fail pre-calculus if you put me in a pre-calculus class right now. I couldn't do a derivative if you put 20 grand on the table cash. Most of the students, even the ones who are low scoring on these tests, can do a derivative and have taken pre-calculus, right? But neither of those things are tested. So guess what? I win, haha, I get a higher SAT score. So I'm smarter. Right. So I think that's part of the whole problem with these discussions is that they just aren't very nuanced and very thoughtful, right? Colleges are realizing that, right? And that's part of the work that I'm doing, is having these discussions with admissions officers, showing them that College Board says the SAT has a 40-point, what they call standard error of measurement. So 1,000, if you score 1,000, it's functionally equivalent to the person who scores a 960 and the person who scores 1,040. So why is a college making a decision accepting 1,000 and rejecting the 980? Right, when College Board is telling me that's the same score. Right, so part of the whole thing and part of the whole test optional movement is recognizing, A, the test isn't giving us as much information as we want it to. B, it doesn't do a very good job distinguishing who's going to be successful and who isn't. Sure, it adds some modicum of information, but is it really worth all the drama, the $2 billion test prep industry, the $2 billion testing industry? Like, do we really want all this crap just to get a 2 to 8% bump on how I predict first year grades, and less than that in how well I can predict graduation? It's not helpful. So that's a lot of what's driving the notion behind test optional.
So I'm wondering, are you seeing an increase in HBCU admissions given the racial awakening that has happened over the last year? And are you even seeing students opting to maybe stay home and to stay in the CUNY system because they're not getting the on-campus college experience, maybe last year, but definitely the HBCUs. Can you speak to a little bit about that?
I can't really. I don't think we have enough. I haven't seen enough data to say anything about what's happening. We do know that, generally speaking, students aren't going as far. We also know that low-income students aren't applying as much as they were before. But we also know that at some HBCUs, applications have skyrocketed, right? And so those seem, yeah. These things seem to be somewhat in conflict. They're not necessarily, you can find rationales for them, but you know, we're gonna need more time to disaggregate the data and understand who felt comfortable applying to college and going to college. How far away did they feel comfortable to go? What were some of the indicators and the causes behind the decisions to apply or not apply, right? Generally speaking, test optional schools saw a bump in applications. Mm-hmm. But a bump in application without a bump in the number of available seats means the school is more selective. So it's a better school, harder to get into? Kinda, not really, right? It just means math happened. Right, that, you know, and that's kind of, that's what a lot of these things are. It's like, yeah, that's the math. They got a whole bunch more applications suddenly. They didn't increase the number of seats they have. So yes, a smaller percentage got in. And probably the statistics of that smaller percentage are higher, because if you have more applications, there's a good chance the higher scoring students that you have a greater volume of those, right? And any college that has chosen to select students based on their statistics are naturally going to gravitate towards higher statistics, right? So that, you know, so there's a lot of things that kind of play into this. And one thing that's left out is institutional priorities, right? Colleges have forever selected based on what they wanted, right? Some of the oldest colleges were simply feeding places for private schools, right? A lot of the colleges started as finishing schools, essentially, for the rich private school kids from the Northeast.
Right.
And that's one of the things for the SAT. It was like, okay, we're gonna diversify. So we're gonna use the SAT as the scholarship test to let in some of those unwashed public school kids, right? So that they can, you know, mingle with our private school fancy hoity-toity kids, right? And then they created the SAT as, you know, the scholarship test, right? But it was really... Yeah, that's what it was created to let in a broader range of white men.
Well, you know what? I feel better knowing that the SAT is a scholarship test, because I didn't get any scholarships and I did not do well on the SAT. So
that's what it started
really
at.
Really helped my confidence.
Way, way back in the day. And that's part of the problem, right? Like these days, that's part of the problem. And that's part of one of the motivations for test optional, is that, like, so if test prep, if people are paying, if generally wealthier folks, right? Because you have to have some disposable income to pay $1,000, $300 an hour, whatever it is, for an SAT tutor, right? So generally speaking, those who do best on the test are wealthier individuals. To award scholarships to those who were able to afford test prep,
yep,
is essentially what you're doing when you're making your scholarships contingent upon test scores. Mm-hmm. That's not merit, right? That's rewarding an investment. I used to work at a test prep company that would essentially tell you, you pay us $1,200 now, you might recoup $20,000 in merit aid from a college. Right? They didn't put it that direct, but that's really, like, because on one side was the pitch for their courses. On the other side was the list of a flyer, was the list of merit awards based on SAT scores. So they put that connection real clear. Right? So, and then to push back against you and for you and your child and taking the SAT once, well, maybe it shouldn't be once. Maybe it shouldn't be that rigid. Because what if your child is applying to, I don't know, North Carolina A&T, I know last year, had a scholarship. I think it was a full ride if you hit a 1400. I'm not sure if it still exists. So if your child gets a 1300, right, on his practice test, and he's looking at North Carolina A&T, should he not prep for the SAT? Well, prepping for it might mean, right, a full ride.
Right, right.
You damn Skippy, he should prep.
Right.
Right, and probably pay some money to prep. That way he has an expert helping him, right? Rather than trying to do it on his own, which would be less effective. So your decision as a parent should absolutely be to prep and test, right? Your decision as somebody who cares about the system working well and fairly should be, we got to kill North Carolina's A&T scholarship program based on test scores. Right? So I'm concurrently doing both things, right? I'll help you tutor your child, and I'm gonna call up North Carolina A&T and be like, yo, y'all need to get rid of this, man. Come on. You can't let these people pay me money to get your full ride and this be a good thing. Because what about the people who really need the money, who could not afford a tutor?
Right.
And now they don't get that scholarship money simply because they couldn't afford a tutor. So that's the challenge of this whole system.
I mean, Akil, you have really dropped some things to think about, to reconsider. And so how can we, like, support you? How can we follow you? How can we, put a deposit for some test prep?
So you can follow me on Twitter. I'm on other social media, but Twitter's really the one that I use. I don't like Instagram, that's foolishness. And I refuse to sign up for TikTok because I'm old. So you can follow me on Twitter, it's just Akil Bello. And how can you support? I mean, I work at Fairtest. Fairtest is a nonprofit. So if you want to support by donating or supporting the work of Fairtest, I'm all on board. Those are really the big things to do right now. Right now, you know, my work is to help inform policy, families, policymakers, and to help us make a better system.
Thank you.
You're welcome. My
pleasure. Yes, thank you.
That was easy.